First of all, I would like to thank the Nobodies for inviting me, and also to thank you for your huge contributions to our struggles, because the Nobodies in London have been very, very helpful in most of, you know, our campaigns, particularly our living wage campaign in London. And I will be speaking on the migrant worker struggle, and I'll be making reference to the London Living Wage campaign, which I was really very much involved in. And I know it's very difficult to really understand the concept of being migrants in struggle if, you know, you're not one. And I really appreciate it, you know, seeing you guys, you know, very much interested in what we go through. And I would like to say on behalf of the cleaners I represent, thank you very much for your huge contribution. And I've really worked closely with her. We always meet in most of our conferences. And I would like to start to say that the cleaners on the underground are predominantly migrants. And as at 2002, they were mostly black cleaners from Africa, particularly from West Africa. And majority of them were actually from either Nigeria or Ghana or Togo, you know, the West African parts of Africa. And, you know, initially the cleaning aspects on the underground were in-house. So the cleaners were actually treated like every other employee on the London Underground, until, like my colleague rightly mentioned, until Margaret Thatcher decided to privatize the London Underground, and the cleaning section was now contracted out to cleaning companies. And then when I came in 1993, obviously that was the easy job. So when I joined, then it was already contracted out, and my employer then was called LI, cleaning contractor, and we were earning £3 something an hour. And then frequently, you know, there were always this bidding for the contracts, you know, we were always being parceled round from one contractor to the other. And so we were paid, you know, peanuts for the huge work we do. And we were subjected to inhuman conditions. And I remember we were not allowed to eat in mess rooms, you know, on the underground. And there was this particular occasion that we were asked to eat outside, and it was raining, we have to stand. And some of us, we began to revolt, to say, you know. And I remember there was a lady, another black cleaner, and myself, we now said, well, if you don't allow us to eat in the mess room, we will not clean the mess room. Because what it was we will clean, but we were not allowed to eat where we clean. You know, it was so they will mess it up, and then we'll be called to clean, but we will stand outside. You know, that was such, you know, we were getting. And even when it was raining, we were not even allowed to sit. So we were eating, in basically eating our meals in the bean room where we were keeping the beans. It was that bad. And at that time, there was nothing like union. You know, we were not unionized. We didn't know our rights. We didn't know what we were entitled to. So we were just, you know, accepting anything we were told to do. And it was the case for 15 years. Basically, cleaners on the underground for 15 years were treated more or less like slaves. Even up to payments, you know, then we would work for 48 hours. And at the end of the week, we would be told, oh, you know, something happened, we're only paying you 18 hours, you know. And there was this occasion I stood up, I said, no, I did even overtime, so because there was no records, and I knew I did up to 60 hours that week. But I was only paid 18 hours, and I said, no, you can do this. And the managers just said to me, where you leave the station. And then that's how bad it was. You can just, you know, you can be sacked anytime and any day. It was that bad. And this continued until 2000, and you know, I was always being sacked. I was sacked from Sodok, and then I went to Blue Diamond, which is another contractor on the district line. What it was that we had over 5 contractors on the London Underground. We had Diamond, we have LI, we had GBM, you know, name it. So I got another job, cleaning job with Blue Diamond, because it was not very easy for us as migrants. We were highly restricted, you know, in terms of getting jobs. And the only job you could get then as a migrant was cleaning. So I was just limited to cleaning, even though I had my certificates. I mean, I was an undergraduate. But I had to leave, and that's why sometimes when I speak, people think I am very, too emotional. But the thing is, I left England because I was very much involved in certain struggles. We had a dictatorial head of state then, and I was in the university, and we were actually involved in a campaign against the... Babangida Must Go, and I was then the branch secretary in my university. But because of my involvement, some of us, our so-called termed ringleaders, were declared wanted. So, my coming to England was just an escape. But when I was in Nigeria, and I was, you know, we were seeing England as, you know, a very clean society, society that is so pure, you know, that are very friendly. So I wasn't really prepared for the inhuman treatment I got when I came here. So it was a bit, wait a minute, you know, is this the England or did I really miss it somewhere, you know? And because I was very used to, you know, I mean, I was born into a society where oppression was the order of the day, and I was always standing up. So on the underground, I found myself standing up to say, no, you know, we're not having this, or we're not having that. Until when I was in Up Minister under Blue Diamond, you know, it was even worse, because Blue Diamond was not even paying us the national living minimum wage. So then ROMT then decided to recruit cleaners into the union. And then so I was one of the first to join in 2000 when ROMT decided. And because I was very, very, I was always opposing, I was one of the very, you know, few reps that were recruited. And so we were now trained to... in terms of health and safety and industrial issues. And so our eyes began to open, and we began to question certain things. And so we were now seen as troublemakers. And in 2007, we began to organize. Then I had 2005, I became the secretary to the cleaners on the underground. And we began to organize the cleaners. And to, because we knew that the only way we could actually resist some of the oppressive ways of our employers was to get organized and then, you know, kind of use our industrial strength. So we got the cleaners organized, And we went to, I remember when we started, because we were, there were two unions then, there was TNG and also ROMT. So we decided to hold a joint campaign. But because of some political interest, TNG had, because they were like seen as the good union, and we, the ROMT, we were seen as the militant ones. And so the employers were not ready. They don't really, you know, want to deal with us. And because TNG had this partnership, something in the sense that the cleaning companies actually give and take the membership dues from the wages and give to the employers. So the TNG, they were always very, you know, the goody, the good union. While we, the ROMT, we don't, ROMT has no business with the employers. So we pay directly to ROMT our dues. So we had some problems having to campaign for the London Living Wage alongside with TNG. And they were not very willing. They thought, oh, it cannot be possible. And remember, the chair then and I, we now had to go to Bob Crowe. We now said, look, Bob Crowe, we've got, we need to ballot the cleaners for a strike. And Bob Crowe said, how do you intend to do that? We said, well, we just want to organize. We, first of all, we want to recruit the cleaners. We want to educate them. But we need some funds. And then he said, well, okay, go on and bring the proposals. Because at that time it was like, how do you organize the cleaners? Because they're scattered all over the underground. They're very vulnerable. And But we knew that we had the same powers. We, without the cleaners on the station, we could, this, the station should not, should, under health and safety, should not be open, should not operate. So we knew we had the same powers with the drivers. And under health and safety, LUL health and safety rules, if a train is not cleaned, the driver shouldn't take the train. And so we knew we could use those strategy and then educate the cleaners do that, you know, you can do what the drivers do to get what they want. And so we went campaigning, we recruited, and we were able to beef the number of the cleaners to from 500 to about 2,000. And when we did that, we knew we were, because the cleaners were actually not aware of some of their rights. So we were going about from station to station and from depot to depot, educating them and speaking to them. And we were getting them signed up. And Bob Crowe was very impressed. And in fact, he released another money, because we were paid, you know, we had to be paid. We couldn't take 2 weeks off work without pay, you know, considering what we were earning then. Then my pay was less than 120 and a week, and so there was no way I could live without that, you know, with that money. It was hard to live. I mean, I was sharing a room, and I was even sleeping on the floor because I couldn't even afford a room. And that was the situation with most cleaners. And most cleaners, we have had to do two or three jobs to make ends meet. And so we decided to campaign, where we were very successful, because when we told them, you know, you can do this, you can decide, you know, they were signing up. And we were now being given another 2 weeks. And so we now decided to call for a ballot. And we, in the history of the London Underground, the cleaners have, for the first time in Britain, the cleaners on the London Underground won a ballot for a strike action unanimously. We got 98% yes votes. And so we went, we called a strike. And we first of all called in July. We had meetings too with some of the drivers who, you know, we had to actually try to pull to our side to say, look, you need to help us. If you don't have, see, even a bag of rubbish or even a piece of paper, you know, use your pass to say, you know, the health and safety, don't pull the train. And some of them were very cooperative, and they helped us. And some station supervised us also. And of course, then it was, we had this group campaign for campaign against border control. They were very, very helpful. Then I was also involved with the Feminist Fight Back and other organizations who were very, very much helpful. And we caught the first 24-hour strike. There was no response. In fact, the cleaning companies underrated us. They said, oh, they will soon get tired. And of course, we had we were campaigning for funds to help, you know, some of our colleagues, who the pregnant women, for instance, and those who really need help. So something we were able to generate funds, because I remember speaking on the gay and lesbian community program, and then the PCS, you know, conference. And we were getting, we were really raising money. We had the gay and lesbian community conference gave us about £1,500. And we made a lot of money. So we were able to give cleaners on every day £40 a day, you know, so they wouldn't really feel the effect of a strike. And then, after the 24 hours, there was no response for our employers. And then we now called another 48 hours. In fact, it was, as at that time, the 48 hours was in first week of August. And it was so much, it was successful that we managed to close some of the trains, some of the lines were grounded, like the central line, like the district line, and then the circle line were very, very successful. And so Mayor now called the cleaning companies to go and negotiate with us. So we were now called to ACAS for negotiation. And then we were able to win the London Living Wage for the cleaners. As at then, it was 7.45. Pounds an hour, £7.45 an hour, as opposed to £5 an hour minimum wage. But what we did not really envisage was the unscrupulousness of our employers, because during the campaign and the disputes, our active reps, those of us that were actively involved, and also the RMT members, were selectively being victimized with the immigration status. In fact, we had situations where suspension letters were given to some of our reps, saying that their national insurance numbers were not correct. Their immigration status became an issue. And these are people, cleaners, who have been working for, some of them been working for 11 years. The country, if they produce their payslip, you would see on that payslip national insurance contributions being deducted on a weekly basis. And for 11 years, there was no issue about immigration. And suddenly, when the cleaners, like Oliver Twist, just asking for a little of what they actually deserve, immigration became an issue. We had situations where border control agencies were called in, and these cleaners who have been working for 9 years, 10 years, were picked. You know, I was fortunate because as at this time, I have been granted leave to remain. Otherwise, I was actually told to bring my passport to a room where the immigration officers, they were just sitting down, dressed like managers, You know, and then when I went in with my passport, they said, "Oh, do you want a cup of tea?" I said, "No." And the lady said, came out shortly and said, "Oh, our fax is not, our photocopier is not working. We're just trying to fix it." But, you know, something tells me that, you know, some officers were examining it. And that was how I was able to escape. Otherwise, I would have just been taken from there to a deportation center and then probably back to home. And we, you know, and this is, the migration issue is being used as a weapon, you know, to systematically exploit the cleaners. And not only exploit in every meaning of the word exploitation, ranging from sexual abuses to physical abuses. We have situations where even the female work cleaners were taken to secluded areas in depots and stations and raped by managers. And these cleaners are too frightened to speak or to even give us written notes of what actually transpired. In fact, one horrific case that each time I remember, you know, it brings tears to my eyes. You know, the way I cry is through my heart. I cry somehow. I don't know if any of you feel that way. You know, bleed through my heart was a particular incident I would ever live to remember that, to, you know. And for the fact that I was helpless as a rep was something I cannot really get over. Where a member, one of my members was taken to a secluded area, sexually abused, was bleeding in the toilets by a manager. And the manager still works freely, but she was too frightened to even give me a statement. We had situations where cleaners were given deadly chemicals. They were too frightened to say no. They know these chemicals are deadly to their head. We have situations where cleaners have, after using these chemicals, they bleed through their nose. There was an instance where my phone rang and I was called that a cleaner called me to say he was bleeding through the nose, and we went to the depot to examine it. We found it, you know, the chemicals affected eight of our members. And I took the case up to the president of the union. In fact, the president of the union was with me when this issue was brought to me. So he actually was very interested and took it on. And then, the manager there was Sarah Welsh, and was the company was ISS. And, they said, they're very sorry to hear that. We should please bring forward the names of the cleaners that were affected for medical checkup. And, you know, I didn't even think of what, you know, I haven't sent such a nice worded letter that she had a hidden agenda. The regional organizer forwarded the letter to me and instructed me to get the names of the eight cleaners affected. And then we submitted the names of the cleaners to this manager. The next thing we heard was that these eight cleaners were asked to bring their passports. And out of fear, the eight cleaners ran off, you know. So we don't know if that bleeding has resulted to cancer in their body. We had a situation where a cleaner was carried from Hainaut Depot. A lady, she fainted when she was asked to use this particular chemical, from acid shed to the female locker room. And when a fellow cleaner called me that somebody has fainted, you know, I said, "Clara, about 2 a.m., because I do day, and this thing happened on nights. We don't have reps on nights, so I cover both night shift and day shift. Do I have more time?" So I went there as a health and safety rep to investigate. And the cleaner told me, no, because by the time I arrived, she was already bullied. She was told, "Look, if you say anything." And so when I said, I was told you were carried, what happened? Oh, no, 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 it was a menstrual pain. I knew she was saying that because of, out of fear, you know. And we have issues like this. So immigration issue is a very serious issue in terms of migrants' labor market, because it kind of creates a fear within migrant workers, particularly those that are very vulnerable, like the cleaners. You know, most cleaners are not educated, and the only job they can get is that cleaning job. So it's a problem, and it's so difficult to organize them because even the so-called reps cannot even be active. I am currently, as I speak, I'm on suspension because I came out and I saw some cleaners who were not trained to do a particular job were being used to do that job. And I just simply asked the manager, why are you using these cleaners? They're not trained. And why are they not even given the appropriate marks? This is a depot that we lost a cleaner, died. This was a young man, 27 years old. He never smoked, he never drank. But when the autopsy was carried out, his liver was found to be jelly-like. And that was because of the chemical that he inhales. The cleaning companies refuse to provide the appropriate mask because they say it's too expensive. So they give dog's mask for them. And so they still inhale this deadly chemical. This deadly chemical is called stripper. In fact, it's stated in the COSH assessment, say that it must be worn, an appropriate mask must be worn, and it must be used in a well-ventilated area. But they don't keep to that, because they want to cut corners, the cleaning companies. And that's why when I said about, exploitation is actually a capitalist something that comes out of capitalist something. Because all the capitalists think about, all these companies think about, is how they can save costs, cut costs, even at the expense of human lives. And so many cleaners are living under this fear and living under a kind of, I don't really think slave is good enough word to use, because even the slaves in the past were not dying of deadly chemicals, let alone now. And where a cleaner would, out of fear, say, not even be able to say what actually happened to her. That is the situation. Like before I finish, and when I just simply asked, I was physically pushed and assaulted by this manager. I called in the police. And of course, because it happened in a London underground, the British Transport Police were involved. He was not even arrested. In fact, the British Transport Police told me, oh, your company should resolve it. And I said, what? This is a criminal matter. And in the following week, I got, the manager instigated his line manager, who was actually one of the key witnesses to my assault case, to victimize me. In fact, he came up to say, oh, you failed to carry out a reasonable instruction. In fact, if I show you one of the disciplinary charges against me, you will be amazed. And then they came up with issues they said happened in December, and this was in March. Simply because I questioned him to say why, because I couldn't really resist asking why or doing my job as a rep, because as a rep, lives are attached to you. You know, I remember going for the funeral because I had to represent the RMT in that funeral, and for 3 days it was very traumatic for me. Having known someone and suddenly losing that person is very, very traumatic. And that is such what the cleaners on the underground. And it's not just the underground, because I happen to work with cleaners with sewers. And I remember during, you know, some of you were involved in the sewers occupation, where five cleaners were deceived to go for a health and safety meetings. And then they, unknown to them, in the hall, in the office of the principal, whoever was in charge of that university, SOAS University, was actually having the immigration officer sitting down. And as soon as the cleaners came in, they were apprehended. And one of them was a pregnant lady. And the pregnant lady was deported as well. Not even our conditions. We have the cleaners even who cannot get access to medical help. Even if they are dying, they buy drugs from, you know, this open market because they cannot get access to the NHS. I mean, when that one now brings to question, does being a migrant, you know, make you less human? Do you deserve to die of cancer from a deadly chemical simply because you migrated into England? And this brings, you know, to question the justice system of this country, because I believe if any law has no moral justification, I mean no moral backing, it's not justified. And that is the case I try to prove in any way I go, that I don't believe in the justice system in this country, because where people are dehumanized simply because they are migrants, they're not entitled to say it's so unjust. And I would like to finish on the note where, as I was saying, that I'm very grateful to groups like No Borders, Campaign Against Migration Control, because they've been very helpful. We had a situation, and I think I say these things because that would actually encourage you to do more. Because we had a situation where I went to represent a cleaner who was on suspension on an alleged case of not signing in out and signing out correctly, because they couldn't substantiate their case. And because they were very, very keen to get rid of, and something that really brings, that has just come to my mind, was the fact that even though the mayor gave us approved the London Living Wage, what he did was he now turned around and gave the contract to Inishu now, who bidded the lowest. So when Inishu came in, April last year, Inishu now used the weapon again of immigration, started asking cleaners to bring their passports. And they were doing that because they wanted to get rid of the cleaners who were tupid over to them on 8 hours. And they succeeded. They used the immigration status to drive to sack a lot of the cleaners on 8 hours. And the new cleaners taken in with right documentation are placed on 7 hours and 6 days contracts, no overtime. I'm one of the old, I have the old contracts. And on my contracts, my contract says Monday to Friday. And I'm entitled to, Saturday is overtime, which is a time and a half. And I'm entitled to bank holiday, with time and a half. The new intake is on 7 hours. There's no overtime rate. There's no bank holiday rate. And that's why it's very, very keen that immigration problem, it's everyone's problem, because I believe in a defeat to one set of workers is a defeat to all. Because what it is, they start from the more vulnerable and they will walk up. Now, even if you're legal, you know your benefits are being eroded by terrible contracts, you know. And so this cleaner was, you know, she just wanted to get rid of him because he was one of the eight hours contracts. And as we were sitting down, and they brought in another matter to say, oh, you know, your contract is not legal because you presented your documents were not genuine. And I said, hang on a minute, that's not why we're here. Oh, we know that, but we're going to talk on that. And suddenly, one of the managers, the HRO manager, Rachel, excused herself. And within 10 minutes, the police were in the room, you know, and just pulled my member. And I said, hang on, you know. Why are you? Oh, we told it's an illegal migrant, and if you were there, it was a very horrific experience. He was just dragged by the. These are British police, you know. I've never seen British police acting. You know, that was my first time acting like the so-called policemen in third world countries that this country criticized. It just pulled him up. And before I knew, another one brought the handcuffs and handcuffed him. And I said, hang on a minute, it's my... And they said, who are you? They just shouted at me. They said, keep off. And as they were pulling him, my member was dragging me, please don't let them. He was crying, please don't let them deport me. Please don't let them take me. And I was being dragged by my member, and the police were dragging him. And I was, you know, he was crying, and I was crying, you know. But he was lucky. I was representing him, and because of my position, I have Bob Crow's number, I have the regional organizer's number, I have the branch secretary's numbers on my phone. So immediately I just text everyone, and Steve came out of a meeting, the regional organizer, saw my number and the message, said, what's happening? And I briefed him, and then immediately called the union lawyer, solicitor. And then when, not unknown to me, that when they handcuffed him, they took him to his house to search for anything to incriminate him. But they told us that they were taking him to Shoreditch police station. So when I sent the text, I sent it, oh, he's been taken to Shoreditch police station. And groups, you know, various groups were, you know, suddenly I didn't even remember that when I send a text, it goes round. So, you know, campaign against immigration got the text, they were there. Migrants Rights Network group were there. No Borders Control, Robin was there. And, you know, Ellen Heffernan. And then Steve was in a branch meeting. So as they finished the meeting, in fact, they had to rush the meeting, the whole branch came. And then the solicitor came. And so when they now saw us, the solicitor came, they were now told them he was in respect of so-and-so. And it was then they were forced to tell him the truth. They said, oh, he was taken to Stoke Newington Station. So we immediately went to Stoke Newington Station. There was a sporadic demonstration, and we had a loudspeaker, we had a megaphone, we demonstrated, and so they were scared, the police were scared. They couldn't take him out into the van to a detention center. And so immediately, actually, Stoke got involved, and the following day, he was released. And so collective, I'm saying this because collective engagements sometimes can solve, you know, some of this deportation. And I will really encourage you and thank you all for, you know, your contributions to our struggles. Thank you.